You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Nearly 13,000. That's how many children are in foster care in Michigan, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. And you look across the country, there are some 400,000 kids in foster care on any given day. But what we don't know for sure is how many children have been lost in foster care. Shenandoah Sheffalo knows how easily that can happen. The Traverse City-based author and advocate put herself into foster care when she was only 13, the only way she could think of to escape her abusive home life and her parents. But it wasn't long before she realized if she disappeared, nobody would care. Nobody would come looking for her. And today she leads a grassroots project called #4600 and Counting. It's aimed at finding those lost children. Shenandoah, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
Your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, is a powerful, unsettling read, which it should be. It tells the story of your childhood and how you wound up at the age of 13 asking, please put me in foster care. Could you give us an idea of what was going on with your father and mother up to that point?
Yeah, well, I had never known my biological father, so he had never been a part of my life. Through that time, I didn't find my biological father until after I turned 18 and was out of the system. And prior to that, I had lived with my mother and, in fact, had been born in San Diego, California. But we had moved over 50 times across the country, 35 schools before I finally graduated from high school. And it was what I think is a pretty typical foster care experience in that lots of dysfunction, lots of mental illness, lots of drug and alcohol abuse and addiction on my mother's part, lots of men in and out of my mom's life and thus my life. And it was dysfunction as we all know and love it. But it was a story that I really wanted to keep a secret from myself and from the world. It wasn't something I wanted to share because it was so painful. When you go through those experiences, you find yourself even as a child, you know, wondering what you had done to ever deserve those sorts of things. And so for me, the idea of sharing this story really came to fruition in my professional life, watching clients in my office at the time working at a criminal defense office who were sort of on that revolving criminal justice wheel, who often disclosed that they had spent time in foster care. Mm. And I thought, gosh, this is Traverse City and it's such a small community. How come so many of our clients could have spent time in foster care? And so that really set me on the wheel of wanting to start to share my story with the idea that if I share the story, right, everyone's always interested in what I call the car accident or train wreck of someone's life. If they would stick around and we could talk about what we need to do to fix it and how the foster care is at the core of so many other social issues that most of us care about in our communities.
Shenandoah, you endured terrible, terrible abuse as a child. It is heartbreaking to read the things that were done to you. And then at 13, you decided to enter the foster care system. Now, tell us what those years were like for you.
Well, you know, I was a 13-year-old girl, and I thought that the foster care system was going to be the answer. You know, I had ideas of Annie and Daddy Warbucks sort of floating around my 13-year-old brain. And I really thought that it was going to be a place where, listen, we've picked the best people our state has to offer to become foster parents, right? They've had background checks, they've gone through classes and training. And so I thought that's what I would get. Unfortunately for me, it was just sort of more of the same. You know, there's this comic, Monroe Martin, who talks about his experience in foster care. And he says, if you don't know what foster care is, it's where we take kids who are in dysfunctional and abusive family situations and we remove them from that and we place them in the exact same situation, but with total strangers. And, you know, I mean, he does it. He's a comedian, right?
Yeah.
But it's really raw and really true at the same time. I mean, that's what makes him so brilliant, is that for me, it was just more of the same. I never fit in. I was never sort of doing what I was supposed to be doing. I could always be doing more. I knew I wasn't part of the family. And some of that was at the whim of foster parents that I lived with. And part of that was, you know, state rules and guidelines that don't allow foster kids to do certain things. You know, you couldn't be part of family photos. You couldn't go on family trips that were outside of the state without permission. You couldn't have sleepovers at friends' house because their parents weren't licensed foster care workers. I mean, sort of all those things that would give you a normal childhood are taken from you. And you're trying to navigate that. Even at 13, as the person who called and put myself into care, I didn't understand all the consequences of what that would be.
And then take us through what happened through foster care. Did you finally age out?
I aged out of foster care, which for me, I turned 18 halfway through my senior year of high school, which means that at midnight, you're done. You're cut loose from the system, and which is why we see that most foster youth who age out will end up homeless. Half the boys will end up with a felony conviction before 19 and a half, and half the girls will end up pregnant before 19 and a half. So it's a large portion. So in my case, I was going to turn 18 halfway through my senior year. All I really wanted was to graduate from high school. I hadn't known anyone who had graduated from high school. That was a big deal for me. And so I was trying to figure out how I was going to do that, how I could stay in school until May to graduate from high school. And on my way to my part-time minimum wage job one day, I thought, well, what if I just offered to pay my foster parents the amount they had been receiving from the state of Michigan? And if I paid them that, would they allow me to just stay until May? Because that would be way cheaper than me trying to get an apartment and a car and transportation and figuring it out. And so I came home from work and asked them, and we ran the numbers, and we realized that if I worked 25 hours a week at my minimum wage, I would barely have enough after taxes to pay them. But they agreed. And so that agreement bought me that extra 6 months of time to graduate from high school. So I worked full time, you know, almost full time at that job, went to school, and was able to get myself to graduate from high school. So that's how I managed some time. During that 6 months, I had a teacher who asked me what my plan was after high school graduation. And I vividly remember telling her, I'm just going to get more hours at this. I was working at a hardware store at the time, at this hardware store. They really like me there. The manager said he'll give me more hours. I could get myself on a management track. And that was my big plan after high school. She thought I should apply to college, which was really the first time in my life anyone had ever even talked about college. She sent me to my guidance counselor's office, and I walked in his office, and he looked me square in the eye and said, you know, Shen, people like you don't go to college. People like you learn to serve people like me.
Whoa.
And I thought, yeah, yeah. And I thought, gosh, you're absolutely right. I mean, people, when I say that phrase to people, you know, I hear a lot of, oh my goodness, or that's crazy, or who could ever say that? But the truth was that 18-year-old girl sitting across from him absolutely agreed with him. I had heard that countless times, you know, social workers, caseworkers, foster parents, judges, every adult surrounding me was essentially waiting for me to turn into my mother.
Boy.
That was the quest held out for me. You know, my mom had two children by the time she was 21, never graduated from high school, had been married, you know, four or five times. I've sort of have lost count. And had this alcohol drug addiction. She had a mental illness. So I thought, listen, at some point, I'm just turning into that. And that was my goal for myself. That was surely everyone else's goal for me. And luckily for me, when I walked back down to my teacher's room and told her the story, you know, her head looked like an 80s horror movie that it was going to spin around and pop off of her body. And she helped me fill out college applications. So much so that when she realized I couldn't afford the application fee, she's the one who eventually stepped up and wrote the $125 check to Michigan State University so I could apply. I eventually got in, and I thought that was going to be my saving grace, right? Like, I got into college, I had a dorm, I had some place to live, and it turned out that it wasn't. And that's where I started having this realization that I could disappear and nobody would even come looking for me. Nobody would even know that I was gone.
But we should tell everybody, and as you learn in reading your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, you did beat the odds. You became one of the only 1% of all foster care kids who graduate from college. You live with your husband and daughter in Traverse City. And it is a story really worth reading. And now you've kind of launched this petition on change.org called #4600 and counting. What's the significance of that name?
So the significant is that every year the child welfare system loses about 1%, 1.1% of the kids in the child welfare system. So we have somewhere between 4,600 kids that no one knows where they are. So state authorities, you know, have taken control of these kids, have removed them from their homes, and they have just sort of miraculously disappeared into the system. And this started when someone on social media shared with me an article out of Kansas about three girls who had disappeared. And ultimately, some state senators were interested in why and had called, you know, and had this big congressional hearing about why these girls were missing. And the article shook me to my core so much, not because kids were missing. I knew kids had run away and gone missing before. We've seen the headlines, you know, kids found strangled or dead, you know, from the foster care system. I knew that was happening. What shook me to my core was it seemed to just be acceptable by all the people in power. It was sort of stated in the article, well, listen, in Kansas, we're missing roughly 73 kids, and that's less than 1.1% of our state foster care population. So we're beating the national average. We're doing fine. Hmm. And it was just sort of the non-caring nature of the somehow the fact that even one kid was missing wasn't one kid too many that just really sort of punched me in my gut. And then I started looking at the numbers. The article then later referenced that there are 4,600 kids missing in 2017 so far. And I reached out to another homeless youth advocate that I knew in Toronto. And I said, I mean, why is nobody talking about this? If you statistically run the numbers, that means they're losing 88 kids a week.
And I think those of us who you know, kind of have that assumption that, well, they're being cared for. Just how are kids lost in the foster care system?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. Obviously, the number one way is by running away, that kids will run away from a foster home. Now, kids run away all the time. Kids run away from, you know, their biological parents' home. Kids run away. It's something they do. The problem is that in foster care, nobody goes to look for them. A kid may run away. A foster parent may or may not report that. A caseworker may or may not report that. And then that's sort of the end of it. Even if that child's reported to authorities, nobody's out there sort of beating the bushes looking for the kid. Now, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and if she ran away, you know, I would have posters up. I would sort of be the person leading the march. And that's part of the problem. There's nobody leading the march for these kids. And so they disappear. And what we know is especially for girls who run away, is that within 48 hours, they will be approached by sex traffickers on the streets. It's a proven statistic. We know that a lot of the kids that disappear from foster care wind up in human trafficking and human sex trafficking rings and organizations.
So what is the whole point of hashtag 4600 and counting? What kind of shape is it taking?
Yeah, it's been amazing to watch the stories pour in from people who have children who have been missing from the foster care system. And more importantly for us, it's about changing what happens. So what we want to see happen is that when a kid enters foster care, that we basically would put together a safety kit for them, that they'd have their photo taken, that photo would be updated every 6 months that they're in care, that we would have some sort of DNA swab taken, and that we have some medical and dental records on that child. So that if they do go missing, we are able to do what we would do for any other child or something that any parent would do for their child, which is put a poster together, put an alert out to be on the lookout for all of those things. What we're finding is that authorities sometimes are finding children both dead and alive that they can't identify because there's no record of them. So that, yes, they've been in the child welfare system, but we don't have any DNA. We don't have any updated photos. We don't have any of those things to help us even identify bodies. And so part of what 4600 and counting is doing is bringing the awareness, letting people know that this is a problem and something we need to address, but also that we need to change the way in which we're approaching the situation. So we want to have these safety kits. And then we want to be able to have caseworkers checking in to make sure that these kids are where they're supposed to be. And we hear oftentimes from caseworkers, and we know that they're overworked. They have too many kids on their caseloads. They can't keep track of everyone. And we're just suggesting, hey, we could bring in some technology to help. It's really easy to Skype or FaceTime with people. Can you do a 5-minute, you know, Skype or FaceTime with the family and the child at least every 30 days so that we're checking to make sure these kids are accounted for? Because there are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
How can people help if they want to? What can people do?
The fastest and easiest way is to log on to change.org and sign the petition. We would love for people to share the video that Marnie and myself put together talking about our own journey, what happened to me, what happened to her. Marnie has a similar story, although she didn't choose foster care the way I did it at 13. At 13, she chose to hit the streets instead and was raped and abused numerous times and lived the life on the streets and understands that really well and understands what that looks like really well. So we got to find the balance of privacy and saving children's lives. And the only way we can do that, that I know how to do that, is by making some noise and making people aware of the situation and getting as many signatures on the petition we can. So both the head of Health and Human Services in the U.S. and the president and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will take a look at it and realize that this is a cause that we need to put some effort and energy behind.
And it certainly seems, just from reading your book, Garbage Bag Suitcase, and hearing you talk, this is also a battle cry to change what you see. Someone who's been through the foster care system, it's broken and it needs fixing.
Well, it's not just broken, it's shattered, right? In my view, we need to make sure that these children are at the core of what we're trying to do to fix it. Because somewhere along the line, we've lost the idea that all these numbers and statistics are beating hearts and real people who grow up. I mean, every child in care is going to grow up and be an adult. And then when they're not acting in a way that we deem socially acceptable, we're going to want to take action against that, right? We're going to want to try to put them in jail or prison to reform their behavior. We're going to want to try to ask, well, why is that mom having all of these children? Why is this mom on welfare? Why is all of this? Why won't they just work? Why won't they just do this? And the answer lies behind not what their current behavior is showing us, but what has happened to them. And I think we've somehow forgotten that these are children who are abused and mistreated. Nobody comes into foster care because things are great at home. Everyone comes in because something really terrible has happened to them. And we have to really help them heal that if we're going to have better outcomes in the future.
You can go to change.org and search for hashtag 4600 and counting to learn more about this effort from my guest, Shenandoah Sheffalo. Her book is Garbage Bag Suitcase. Shenandoah, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.